welcome to Culturally and Technically Legal, the show where we examine the intersections of culture, technology, and law. Today, we have a very, very, very special guest who wears so many hats, from CEO to engineer to consultant to lawyer, best-selling author, literally everything. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Ms. Jules Okafor to Culturally and Technically Legal. How are you doing today, Jules?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing extremely well. So happy to finally get to sit down and have a conversation with you. You have so much knowledge in that head. I know you got a lot going on right now, so just happy you've been able to like make the time to talk to us. Before we get into everything, I want you to tell viewers at home and give them a little bit of a background about yourself.
So I am the CEO and founder of Revolution Cyber. We are a security culture as a service firm, and what that means is we help organizations to optimize and enable their security organization, focusing on the people-centric aspects like culture and people resourcing. And we've been doing this since about 2019. I'm also an attorney, recently an author, and a lot of the spaces in which you'll find me are those intersections. So a lot of times we're working with clients to solve really complicated problems around secure coding and how developers can integrate training and learning into the way that they code, working with senior leaders, but how they can strengthen relationships across organizations very quickly, or how to scale resilience to various parts of companies that exist across the globe. And so those are the challenges that we're solving now, using technology as automation and scale.
Wow, it seems like you definitely got your hands in so many of the right places. So obviously there's viewers who've heard about cyber risk or cyber safety, and that conversation, and they think they're doing the right things of, okay, yeah, I log off of Facebook every time I'm on there, right? Or I get rid of that app when I'm not using it. I you know, iPhone users, you snap out of Instagram and stuff like that. But could you describe to them, like, the actual cyber vulnerabilities that are out there and threats that are out there that we may not necessarily think of in our day-to-day, because we aren't, like, none of us are really cybersecurity experts to begin with, but there's many threats and vulnerabilities. Could you kind of, like, elaborate to some of those and kind of tell us what those are?
So I like to speak in threes. I think threes are the most memorable. So if we start with the first, this idea of social engineering, and individually, none of us, you know, unless you're kind of high profile, are targets specifically of nation states or bad actors. But when we're connected to things that they find important or opportunities for financial benefit, then we can be a target. So for instance, if you're banking at a major bank and you're a customer, it may be that they want to take your credit card information, but it may be that access to your credit card information gives them some sort of interest or ability to get into the bank, Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase. So we are almost always being targeted in ways that may have nothing to do with us. So the way to think about it is, what are the things that I'm connected to, places that I potentially could pose risk? Like, we all work at different companies. We all maybe are going to school at places. Our actions actually impact those institutions' actions. So we need to be very thoughtful about how we're using our computers, where we're using our email addresses, who we're allowing to see sort of over our shoulders if we're traveling. All of that becomes very important for the effort of social engineering. And then secondly, I ask people to think through social media as sort of this, it feels comforting and like you know it, but we have very little control over the data that's shared on social media. In fact, we're finding more and more, the more important the jobs are that you intend to have in the future, the more likely that job is actually monitoring your social media accounts when they're putting you through the hiring process. Wow. So you want to be careful what you're saying. Some of the things that may be, because if I think back to college and high school, I'm very glad there was no social media because I had a very good time. Gen Z, be very careful because you may think that you're having just a good time with friends. A lot of times, if you're sharing, you know, unpopular opinions online, those may come back to haunt you at a time when you're trying to get a federal government job or you're trying to take the bar where you're being licensed. So you want to think about what you're saying online because you don't control where that information goes. And actually, the job of those that media is to take that information and scale it for their own purposes. Wow. So you want to think about that. Wow. So what you're sharing and who you're connected to online, what you're saying to people and you know how you're communicating online. And then thirdly, your physical presence. So I talk a lot about supply chain risk to companies. But we don't think as people about what we bring into our homes. So I've always loved the Samsung fridge, the LG fridge with the TV screen, where you can like watch TV while you're, you know, making dinner in the kitchen. The amount of data that they collect in order to provide you the information you're receiving is substantial. I use Alexa. I use Amazon's product. Some people use Google or Cortana. And those are actually listening in your house. Alexa's at the point where it can tell you, it can tell me if my dog is barking when I'm outside the house and send my dog a message so it hears my voice. Wow. Think about what kind of information that needs to extract. Think about the fact that it's taking that, analyzing it, and using it for a different purpose. There are legal contracts that you would have signed where you waive your right for what information they're collecting. So if we think about sort of law and we think about this need to get a warrant, in a situation where, let's just say you're committing a crime that can be heard by Alexa, what is Google or Amazon's relationship with the police, and do they have a requirement to share that, right? So we always want to think about the places that we hold sacred and how they're being dominated in ways that we can't see, that are not transparent. And you want to always think about, what am I saying? And if this was shared with anybody else, would I be impacting myself or someone else? And that's the way to think about it.
Wow, that was a deep answer, because it made me start to think about things like privacy law, made me start thinking about the Fourth Amendment when you started connecting like the government and police officers. So that's interesting. But to shift gears, two things that you said that really stood out to me. You said having a good time, and you said what we're connected to, right? And for me, having a good time, I think about Las Vegas, right? So recently in the news, we saw MGM and Caesars were compromised from a cyber ransomware attack, right? Is that something that we see in the future happening more frequently? And in that attack, like you said, they took people's data, credit card numbers, social security numbers.
Yep.
How does that happen to a companies to this magnitude, right? And then, you know, not only companies to this magnitude, you know, why those particular pieces of information to begin with?
Yeah, I think people overestimate the challenge it is to actually secure an organization of MGM size. So you might think of MGM as the casinos in Las Vegas, but MGM has at least 30 properties that are global. So they are manning properties in Macau, in China, in Hong Kong, and various places across the globe. And it's a security team that is distributed, but they're mostly centralized in Vegas. So if you think about the scale of the problem, meaning you've got this extended attack surface, companies, systems across the globe, You can't hire enough people to protect yourself from all the hackers in the world.
Wow.
The only thing you can do is a few things. One, you can put enough protections in place to delay the impact of the attack. One. Two, you can hire enough people, and then you can complement them with technology that extends their reach. And then the third one is you have incident response in place to respond, because you know the incident is going to happen. So I think more importantly, could it happen again? Yes, because the problem can't be solved. The problem is there's no solution to the problem today. But I want us to not just focus on MGM, because I think given their situation, they also made a business choice to not pay the ransom. Mm. Caesars had a similar breach about the same time, and they paid.
$15 million.
The question is, were they wrong for not paying? We won't know for a long time. But if they had paid, what would have been the implications of those decisions?
Wow.
And I think we're seeing more and more emboldened criminals using ransomware and a combination of social engineering, which happened where they went through the help desk to get access to credentials to particular systems. We will continue to see that as a modus operandi, because humans are the first and often the easiest targets for getting into company systems.
Wow, that's interesting. Yeah, I did see that Caesars had put up $15 million, and like you said, we don't know the results of not paying or paying. It's too soon to tell. So we've seen other big attacks in the past, like, you know, Sony Pictures with the whole North Korea thing for putting out the Interview movie. What has our national defense team, the agencies like NSA, CISA, and FBI, what's their strategy with all of this from a national standpoint? And also from an international standpoint, when we are in conversations with countries who do pose a risk, like China, North Korea, Iran, et cetera?
So the geopolitical tensions are at the forefront of the cybersecurity attacks happening. And I would say the strongest strategies that the U.S. is using are not ones that we can see or even I can speak to, because I'm not a member of the NSA or some of those three-letter agencies. What I will tell you is that it has always been, like we do with the military, a combination of strategies that some we see, some we don't see. A lot of it is in diplomacy, bilateral agreements that we make not to go after each other, terms that we set that ensure that if you attack me, I will attack you, or we say we're both going to protect each other from these countries that continue to attack us all. So there's a diplomatic piece to cybersecurity that we don't get to see. And it's why we see Biden flying to places, we see the Secretary of State going, and members of the White House team. What I will also say is that the three-letter agencies have been very clear about the fact that they understand that there are known risks to the national security of U.S. as a result of cyber attacks. So we recently saw the White House executive order, and there's been tremendous effort by the GSA, the FBI, and many of DOD to come together on strategies to reduce the risks associated with where the U.S. has its interests, military bases, systems that we are doing in concert with other countries, so some of our ports. There is work being done. The issue is it at the speed by which the hackers are able to get to us? I'm not so sure that I see that, because the bureaucracy slows everything down.
Okay.
There's a lot of ways you have to do it, and they're trying to come up with more efficient, more effective ways, but the government is slow to move. It's just stability requires that things move slowly, so sometimes we can't react as quickly as we should.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I think one of the things that I see more, I was recently in Japan, and also recently took a trip to California. In Japan, I was in a restaurant where there's robots literally serving me, right? And then in California, I see my first self-driving vehicle, right? And not to blow on the technological things that are happening, but realistically, we are moving into a space where we'll start seeing more smart cities, more technology-driven cities, right? And I could imagine that, you know, you're going to see more cyber risks. You're going to see more technological threats and vulnerabilities coming from there. What do you see in the future for protection of us? Are we going to need, like, I don't know, cyber insurance plans or anything like that in the future? Or what do you literally see? Like, how do we continually protect ourselves with technology just ever growing the way it is?
My first suggestion is we don't fight it. We embrace it. The U.S., and as far ahead as we are in technology on a global scale, in terms of the adoption of technology as individuals, we tend to be behind. The phones that we see, I'm Nigerian, my family there, they've had the phones for a while.
Wow.
In the UK and in China, they've had those phones for a while. So there is actually deliberate attempts to slow down to ensure we're not going so far and fast that we're missing security. But what I'll say is there's not been the motivation by companies to build secure from the beginning, to embed security as a part of IT, not something separate and bolted on. And I'm also seeing that the way in which security is designed, where investors drive what the solutions are, is a flawed model. We actually need to see consumers requiring that there be greater security around the data that's being collected for benefit by the company, and demanding that it not be another service that I add on, like we just saw X. You know, if you subscribe to the $8 per month, you have the ability to use MFA, and if you didn't, then you were kind of out there. Mm. That model's flawed. What we've got to say is, if X wants to move into the future and be this huge payment hub, they should be providing security as a part of the basic service. It should be a basic level service. So I think we'll start to see more movement in AI and those sort of things. But always with technology, we bring with it the biases and the issues that we've had that we haven't addressed. All we do is then take that same problem into the future, and it looks a bit different.
Oh, no, that's interesting. And I want to ask you one last question. Recently, in Congress, there's been bills proposed, right? The American Data Privacy Protection Act and also the DELETE Act, right? Yeah. They've been proposed. Nothing passed yet. Where does that fit into all this, you know, in the event that they are passed? Because it seems like they kind of put handcuffs on third-party data distributors. Do you see that as possibly helping us, or do you think that could possibly hurt us in the future?
As an attorney, of course, It's a little bit of both.
Okay.
There's no one thing that's either one or the other. You're always measuring risk and reward. I've not even till today seen where different government regulations have done a good job to understand the operational and financial impact of the regulation, so that the risk that they're reducing is matched by the rewards of actually complying with it. All it does is increase the amount of money it costs to start a business, increase the amount of taxes that people pay, and then are we getting the benefits we want to get out of it? So I'm not for more regulation. I'm for smarter regulation done in collaboration with people who understand the operational impact. Not the big companies, the small companies who say, we want to be part of that privacy conversation, but we've got to be able to do that, and it's got to be affordable for us to continue to do business, because that's the driver for why we're in business, right? So I don't see a lot of smart regulation. So I'm not excited about any new privacy regulation coming down the pike.
Makes sense. And then I'm going to leave you with this. Obviously, I have a lot of listeners, you know, who are just learning about this whole cyberspace, right? And then some who knew a little bit about it. And then we have some who, you know, are well-versed in it. Could you just provide maybe five, you know, totally quick points with the listeners about how they can practice better cybersecurity hygiene on their own?
Sure. So one, it's all a mindset. You've got to make cybersecurity a lifestyle rather than a one-time choice. Got to think about it through the course of how you're making your day-to-day decisions. Two, consider who you let into your house, even if it's the fridge, a microwave, or your neighbor. What access do they get? What line of sight do they have to some of the things that you maybe don't want them to see? And think about whether there's somebody you could turn your back on, because that's important for you to always think about. Three, you want to figure out your connections. Who are you connected to? What are you saying to those people? How do they align with where you're trying to go in your life? You're going to say a lot of things today that you're going to look back on and be embarrassed about. Don't say it if you can avoid that. So I try to think ahead, right? Some of the presidents that we have today, they had to consider that they would be presidents so that there weren't things to come after them with. So if you're the next president, think about what you're saying today. Four, bring in your friends and family. So it doesn't matter if you secure yourself and you're guarding your credit cards and you're, you know, protecting your system, and yet your family PC is left out and open with no screen filter, no password. You want to make sure you're protecting your friends and family. Give them as much access to information as you collect. And then five, share your knowledge. What you learn, put it online. Because what we want to do is counter a lot of the bad information that's online. So as you learn, it's our job in our community, legal communities, friendship communities, to continue to share that knowledge. And that way, we can sort of diplomatically start to teach people what they need to know as well.
Wow. Thank you so much. You was very, very informative today. Gave me a lot of knowledge that I didn't come here before. So we're about to wrap up the show. I just want you to let everyone know the name of your new book and where they can find it at.
Sure. So I've written a book with 15 other Black female authors. It's Securing Your Future, Embracing Resilience in, I guess, Cybersecurity. So 15 of us got together. It's on Barnes & Noble and Amazon. We decided that we were kind of the hidden figures in cybersecurity. And what we wanted was to reflect more women who look like us, how dynamic we are, how stylish we are. I've got a t-shirt. I've got this on now, but check
me out. I need one
of
those.
Yes. But we know how to rock these things, but you can be yourself and be authentic and be successful. And so we wanted to show what that looks like in cybersecurity. So we will be doing a national tour. If you get a chance, we'd love to have you come out.
Oh, man, that sounds good. Well, Jules, thank you again a ton for joining me today, dropping all them gems. And Jules, no pun intended, looking forward to connecting with you again soon. Thank you again. And everyone, thank you for watching today's episode of Culturally and Technically Legal, where we examine the intersections of culture, technology, and the law. Thank you.